Walter Jacob, February
23,
1997.
No, I think we're still in January.
We're still in January.
Where are you going in February?
Yeah.
Fun place. January 23, 1997, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. Dr. Jacob, do you want to continue about Jewish education? Is there anything else you'd like to say about it, or shall we go on?
Well, the only thing that I think one has to say is that it's necessary to remind parents that weekend religious school was always intended as a supplement to whatever went on at the home. And if it becomes the primary source of Judaism, it's going to fail. So a lot of people have lost sight of that. And of course, the other thing that works very well and that's helpful is sending kids to camps, various kinds of camps in the summer, where there is a more intense experience than is likely to take place at home.
Okay. Last time we talked at length about the new prayer book. You mentioned how you ease the congregation into it gradually. Number one was, what was the date of the publication? Of course, we can look that up. But why was it found necessary to make a new prayer book at that time?
The prayer book was issued, I believe, in the 1970s, or mid-1970s, 76, something like that. And people had worked on it for almost a decade before that. We've had a history of changing the prayer book about every quarter century. So that if you look at the Union Prayer Book, there's a revised version, then there's a newly revised version, and now we have the Gates of Prayer with the subtitle as the Union Prayer Book. The change is largely necessary partly because of language changes. And that's rather drastic between the Union Prayer Book in the newly revised version and the Gates of Prayer. The other was in sort of classical English, these and thous. Difficult for a lot of people to use or to relate to. And it also meant that you had prayers removed one additional step from everyday life. And that really shouldn't happen. If that happens to some extent when you use Hebrew, because you may or may not understand Hebrew too well. But the English prayers ought to then at least be in language that is everyday language. The other issues were that some of the focus had changed. There was a feeling in the 60s and early 70s that you had to teach people how to pray again. So part of the Gates of Prayer, in which may now in the 90s rub us to some extent the wrong way, is that it tries to convince the person that there is some benefit from prayer, that there is a God, that kind of an approach. The problems with, and then of course there were some initial effort, but that didn't go very far at that point, but has gone much further now, is to deal with gender issues. But that really was on nobody's agenda at that time. So if it happens in the Gates of Prayer, it's more or less by accident. In the Gates of Repentance, which appeared 5 or 6 years later, initial efforts in that direction were made.
In the gender?
In gender, and also some changes in the approach, so that the approach is less didactic and now more prayerful. There were a couple of other changes made. which I think were quite effective and well done. Instead of having the English and Hebrew on opposing pages, which means you always have to make a clear-cut choice which page you can use, it's intermingled. And so that enables you to read a paragraph in Hebrew and then go on with, skip the English translation and go to the next paragraph in English. Very often the translation is not a translation, but is a paraphrase, or not even a paraphrase, but deals with the essential ideas of the Hebrew prayer and presents them in a way that has meaning for us.
Has the Hebrew been changed?
The Hebrew has not been changed, with only the most minor exceptions. But it has been changed from the traditional prayer book, and that a lot has been left out. And of course, what we fail to remember when we look at a Reformed prayer book where we make these changes systematically is that they have occurred all through the ages unsystematically, and that people have always added prayers. Some poetic soul, they liked what he said. The next edition of the prayer book included that by virtue of the committee or the person who arranged for his publication saying, we want that prayer here, put it on page 10. Now, of course, when enough of that had happened, the prayer book got to be too big. And so the same person would say, you've added this prayer, but this one on page 12, we don't really understand it. Why don't you just leave it out? And so in that informal way, a lot of the medieval poetry was dropped and either not replaced or replaced by later prayers. And that continues to happen in the Orthodox prayer book. You may not even notice it.
In the Orthodox prayer book?
Sure, I'm talking about the Orthodox prayer books only now. This informal way of doing it. But if you took the trouble to take a different prayer book to services, let's say on a daily basis or every Shabbat, you'd see the major changes and the major differences as you wander through the decades and certainly through the centuries. Now, the downside of all of this is that the Union Prayer Book, newly revised, was done by four people, in theory. My guess is two of them did most of the work, and they both had a good sense of language and poetry. The Gates of Prayer were done by a large committee, then were circulated to the entire conference for comments and changes and suggestions. And the result is that much of it is not poetic. It's very pedestrian in language. And that's a problem.
Well, that's so in Christianity, too. Have you seen the Good News Bible?
Well, but actually, yeah.
I mean, you know, the argument there is the King James Bible is poetry, it's language.
Yes, but it has gone so far that the same is true of the Bible translation, which was the Jewish one finished in the 60s after 25 years. It had gone so far from the ordinary vocabulary that if you gave a Bible to a confirmation class, you had to translate English into English. And so actually I've used the Good News Bible with kids also, and with adults, also in preference often to the Jewish Publication Society version, which again had the problem of being done by a committee with relatively little sense of poetry, and often is rather flat and still sometimes somewhat stilted. There are a lot of Bible translations out there now. There always have been, but there is now a new, not of the whole Bible, but of the Torah, a translation done by a single person. And that, we've had three Bible translations in America. The first was done by a one man in the last century. Wasn't even a great scholar. If he'd been a great scholar, he probably wouldn't have been able to do it because he would have asked himself too many questions.
What was the name?
His name was Isaac Leeser. And that was L-E-E-S-E-R. And that took us to the first decade of this century, a little later than that, actually, almost in the First World War, when the Jewish Publication Society Bible became the Bible, and we used that to the 60s with all of its intricate King James-like English, and now have this version, which is okay, but it's not great. And other people obviously sense that, so they're doing their own thing.
Well, I guess that's how it is. But
and we'll have another prayer book soon, if we go back to the prayer book.
On the internet.
Which, well, not on the internet, but a book which will deal with the gender issues and the other issues of the 90s. We are feeling more spiritual, which will mean that this prayer book will be more poetic, less flat-footed.
Okay.
But I also ought to say something that there's another development, which is probably not a very good development. Same thing has occurred in the churches. We've used a lot of, as we always have through the ages to some extent, folk music, pop music, at camps. And the kids then like it, and eventually, usually they grow up, and then they bring it into the adult service too. And a lot of that is, it's singable, but it's often very poor from a musical point of view, and very boring, and very repetitive.
But on the other hand, certainly in this congregation, with becoming a meeting learner, well, I guess we'll talk about a little bit, and the response that she's getting from the congregation is very positive.
Oh, that's yeah, great. Yeah, but she has kept herself.
She brings the old melodies.
Well, not only old melodies, but also new melodies, but melodies that are a little more sophisticated.
How do the children respond to what?
Maybe
learn her, she hardly
ever sees the children, because we've got other people in the religious school. But you've got sometimes on a Saturday morning when they are singing a melody which begins with la 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 la, I say to myself, these people all have a college education. You might as well give them a word instead of singing that. If they used that sort of thing in a Hasidic community in the 18th century where the people were illiterate, that's a different story.
Okay. I'm looking at your list of books. You've talked about the responsive. Many, too many to talk about. Maybe I'll let you choose one or two, but the one that I have a star next to is Christianity Through Jewish Eyes. Do you want to respond to that? Would you like
sure. That was really my first book, I guess. And in an effort to... I saw that although we conduct a lot of dialogue, nobody had really bothered to take a hard look and see what had Jews said about Christianity in modern times. And what have they said beyond, you're sitting together neighborly, you talk about non-controversial issues and or social issues on which you can readily agree. But what about the tougher things? I mean, what attitude do we have toward the New Testament or towards Jesus or toward Paul or toward Luther, all those folks? And so I started to look into that and decided to, after a brief look, saw that although there were discussions in the Middle Ages, I'm not talking about the disputations, which were always difficult. No matter what you said, what you thought, you couldn't say what you thought, because if you said what you thought, you were likely to get your head cut off instantly. But there were also some discussions of Christianity, but very, very few, really. The whole thing began with Moses Mendelssohn at the end of the 18th century, and then developed quite rapidly into the 19th and 20th century, so that you really had Jews dealing with every major aspect of Christianity, from a thorough, scholarly, historical, as well as theological point of view. And it proved to be an interesting study. And it's still a book that's used, although it's now more than 20 years since it's been published, still used in a lot of college courses.
General college.
Yes.
And also the theological college.
Yes, various seminaries use it, and thus far nobody else has done anything quite like it. It really should be brought up to date because various authors have written in the last 20 years.
Hebrew Union colleges.
Yes. They initially published it, and then a commercial publisher took it over, continues. I gave it to the college. Continues to pay royalty to the Hebrew Union College.
Would that bring us, not directly, but indirectly? Have you had any personal anti-Semitic situation?
No, not since Germany, and that was...
That was big. That was me. No, I mean in America. I'm sorry.
No, I must say I haven't. And that is despite being, or maybe because, I was largely in areas, I grew up in areas where there were no Jews, or very few Jews.
Right.
So in Springfield, Missouri, I was always asked to be sort of to explain Judaism in classes and the like, never had any anti-Semitic incident of any kind there.
How would you counsel someone?
And also not, let me mention also not, I think I mentioned that before too, in these Forest Service camps in northwestern Montana. And also not in the military. Now, these are all situations in which Jews were small minorities.
Has anyone come to you for counseling when they've had an anti-Semitic?
Yes, they have. And I think the first thing I try to do is see how real it is. Because in some instances, certainly not all, either people are overly sensitive or may magnify a rather small incident into a major matter. Or there are peripheral situations where it's really wiser not to make an issue of it, like decorating the office at Christmas time with Christmas decorations.
Okay, how about the one at the courthouse here with the crash in the menorah? It goes on every year. What are your feelings there?
Well, my main feeling is that we shouldn't have either one. But if it comes right down to it, maybe I wouldn't do that in Pittsburgh, but I would certainly do that in Springfield, Missouri, if somebody started raising the issue. And I were a rabbi there, I would say, this is not an issue worth raising. That in that community where there are, I think now, maybe 200 Jewish families, so maybe 600, 700 Jews out of 2,000 200,000 people, let's forget about it. It's not the amount of fuss that it's going to raise is not going to be worth the good that it might do on the other side.
How about the issue in the high schools of the prayers for commencement using the word Jesus Christ? It's been quite.
Well, I think that it's. I would rather proceed along the lines of counseling than lawsuits.
Yeah, but it's always after the fact these things come up.
Well, yes, but if you then talk about it a little bit to the people in the next graduating class and say to them, look, not everybody believes in Jesus. You've got some Jews here, you've got some Buddhists here, you've got some people who don't, who are not anything. And they're all part of our class. We ought to make everybody feel comfortable. You will nevertheless have the sort of thing as you had with Billy Graham at the inauguration.
I couldn't believe it.
Well, all right, but I mean, I don't think that's worth calling him an anti-Semite.
No.
Or making a big to-do about it.
Oh, I couldn't believe it.
Particularly as it was kind of funny. He started to pray, and I was at home watching this thing, and I decided that I was going to cut up some vegetables for lunch, and I could still sort of vaguely hear it, but when I got back, which must have been 10 minutes later, he was still praying.
Well, he's been on praying.
It was forever, and it was not particularly poetic. The minister who gave the closing prayer, the Negro, was far better, far more poetic. I mean, that was a beautiful prayer. So my feeling there is more that pick your spots where you're going to fight, and don't make a tremendous issue of something that can be handled in other ways and probably lead to the same result.
Well, this is the whole trend of your thought and philosophy as we've been talking.
Yes.
For 10 hours, and it's very positive, certainly. Are there any other books on this list that
are any good?
Well, that are any good.
A bestseller.
They're all good. Of course they're good.
See, what I've been working on in the last, I should mention that, in the
yes.
last 6 years
yes.
with my colleague in Israel.
Oh, yeah.
Is this whole series which deals with Jewish law and very specific issues. And we are now working on volume 8. And by the time we get to Pittsburgh in 1999, we'll have 10 volumes. We'll be working on the 10th volume. So that volume will probably be one that deals with the principles of Reform Jewish halakha. That should be an interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
The one before that, the one for which I'm now inviting speakers, will deal with gender issues in Judaism.
Can you be more specific?
Well, what role does gender play in the synagogue? What role should gender play in the home? Balancing things out there. What do we really do with not only the liturgy, but you know, you've then got the biblical readings. What are you going to do there when you have a text which you really don't want to change in its translation? And whole sets of other things that in which gender gets involved too. Just the whole relationships which have to be where the focus has to shift. So how do we do that, and how do we say that, what does Judaism say about it in detail?
Okay. And that'll be a bestseller.
Well, it won't be a bestseller, but these things are too academic to ever be bestsellers, but they have a surprisingly large readership.
May I ask a question? Sure.
in relationship to this, what could you define? This is a hard question, but what is a Jew? When you talk about being Jewish, what is there a way of defining it so that it can go into the whole picture?
Well, what is it? It's impossible in a couple of minutes to define what is a Jew, but because there are various elements to it. There is the religious element, there is the, you might say, the national element, and there is the element which is simply genetic, or however you want to define that. And national means, beyond that, just ethnic. So as we have never clearly settled among ourselves, what is the more important? I mean, I certainly feel that the religious element is more important. A nationalistic Jew in Israel will lean in that direction and say, the fact that I live in Israel and never go to a synagogue makes me as good a Jew as you who go to a synagogue and try to do something about social issues and problems. While others will say, you know, I live in a Jewish environment, I eat pickles, and I have a lot of Jewish friends, and that's enough. So as we are so broad in our definition, you might say, it's my leaning would be that we need to require certain things of Jews, and that,
sure,
that's the only way in which it makes any sense, such as all the things that Reform Judaism and Judaism talks about.
Okay.
Right. No, that's fine. I
have another question. Have you always been a Zionist?
Yeah, I suppose I've always been a Zionist, but you have to define that.
I don't mean politically. I mean.
No, on the one hand, I've also always been a Zionist. On the other hand, I've never been a Zionist. Because I've always favored the creation of the State of Israel and a strong Israel. On the other hand, a Zionist, if that person is somewhat logical, should be living in Israel. And I'm not. I have no intention of being in Israel. So it moves in both directions. I've certainly done whatever I could to support Israel in the broad sense, not necessarily the policy of a particular government, which I think many of us have always had trouble with.
How about your father?
People at different times.
Yeah. How about your father?
My father was supportive of Israel, but more skeptical about the long-range possibilities of Israel. And, you know, who is right, we'll have to wait a while to see.
How about Dr. Friedhoff?
Dr. Friedhoff was supportive of Israel, but not... did not wish to take a strong Zionist stand when the issue was controversial.
But once it became a fact?
Yes. Yeah. And I guess there we would differ, that I was willing to take a stand on that even when there were a lot of people who were opposed.
Do you want to talk about the people who were opposed at that time? There was a strong.
Well, they were opposed pretty well for the same reasons that people had been opposed in the earlier stage of Jewish history, earlier in this century, that individuals felt that they were at home in the country where they lived, and that they ought to put their energy into that. But I think most of these people were not people who were insensitive to the needs of refugees and the like. So in many instances, that opposition vanished after the Second World War, when you had to deal with people, hundreds of thousands of people, no place to go.
I think this might be a good place to stop.